Here's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Yeah, Marjorie, just as we get started, I'm watching the TV. Wakes, memorials, burials. I mean, it just, it never ends.
There is some breaking news today. The 8-year-old Martin Richard from Dorchester has apparently been buried, and so his funeral and his burial are done. And, of course, we know the burial and funeral for Sean Collier went on this morning as well,
the MIT police officer. Joining us, as he does every Tuesday at noon, is John King. He's CNN's chief national correspondent. As you know, he spent much of last week in his hometown, positioned right there in Copley Square. John, welcome and good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And just before, as I was waiting to come on, I saw the statement from the Richard family about Martin's burial this morning. And that's sad, very sad. That's home for me. Dorchester, and I spent a lot of time there when I was up in Boston, and it's tough on these families. It's good to hear Boylston Street's reopening, but it's tough to remember a lot of these families still have a long, long trek ahead.
Well, John, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I mean, you are from Dorchester. The Richard family is from Dorchester, very well known in Dorchester. You're one of the few reporters that grew up here. It had to be somewhat personal for you covering the story these many days.
Well, it was personal covering the story, and as you noted a bit earlier, I was also part of a pretty big mistake we made at CNN, and that made it even more personal and, you know, a kick in the head and tough to deal with. But in terms of the big picture of the story, sure. I grew up in Dorchester. I got a son at Boston College. All of my siblings are spread out around the Boston area. So it's personal because it's home. It's the place you love. And then, you know, when you go down the charter school where Martin went to school is on Queen Street, which is right off King Street where I grew up, and Carruth Street's where some of my friends lived when I was growing up, and my paper route went right up through that neighborhood, near that neighborhood. And I was trying to explain to people, when you're from Boston, especially when you're from Dorchester, when people ask you where you are, you know, I'm from St. Mark's, he was from St. Anne, so you do it by your parish.
Yeah.
So you're reminded of some things from your youth that make you smile, and then as you start to smile, you get so sad.
John, you mentioned the mistake. You took some heat, if people don't know this, for reporting last Wednesday about 1:45 that a suspect had been arrested. It turned out to be a mistake, as you just mentioned. Some of your critics said it was about getting the story first. What happened?
It wasn't about getting the story first, but look, you're in a competitive situation. And earlier in that day, I was very proud of our reporting. We were among the first, if not the first, to report about, you know, them making huge progress in the investigation because of the video review. And then we had two sources at CNN. One of them was mine, was a Boston source, and one of them was one of my colleagues. It was that hers was a federal law enforcement source who said a suspect had been arrested. We had two sources, and we went with it, and we pretty quickly got information from other people that was inaccurate, and we had to correct it, and it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing anyway. I've been at this for nearly 30 years. I've covered a lot of cops and robbers stories and 7 presidential campaigns and a couple of wars, and I've broken a lot of news in my career. And I didn't just fall off the apple cart and make a stupid mistake, but it is a stupid mistake. And you got to take it back. All you can do when that happens, you're talking to people who you've trusted as sources, who tell you things that they've been good to you in the past, they've been reputable sources. You report it, and then you find out you're wrong. There's only one thing you can do, and that's look the viewer in the eye and say, we were wrong, and explain why you were wrong, and try to move on, and be careful. But it's embarrassing, no question, a kick in the head.
John, you were far from alone. I mean, the Associated Press was reporting the same thing, and by the way, their correction was virtually whispered, if mentioned at all. Fox, the Boston Globe. How long after you did the original reporting did you find out that your sources were wrong, and how long after that did you make the correction on CNN?
I don't, Jim, have the chronology in front of me, so if I get this off by a couple minutes, I don't want anyone to take issue with it, so I'm not going to give a specific time. But I know that, within a couple of minutes, a couple of our other correspondents heard from people who said, you know, I don't think you guys are right. And then I got a call from a Justice Department official saying, please call me. And I checked in, called back that person in Washington and said, look, yes, there can be confusing information. So just to make sure, you know, I'm not late in the chain, I just went as high up as I can go, which means to the Attorney General of the United States, who is closely following the investigation, of course. And that source said, you know, there's a lot of confusing information out there, but there has not been an arrest. And so then we started, you know, then we fixed it. And there was clearly something going on that morning. You're right, a handful of news organizations, a handful of very good news organizations, reported it. That doesn't excuse my mistake and our mistake, but there was clearly something going on, and some people had information which turned out not to be true. And that's always a tough one when you're talking to people who you know and people who you trust and people who have been reliable in the past, including, you know, within the past 48 hours, if you've covered this very story. That's always my test of a source. Sometimes you check back with sources you haven't talked to in a couple of years when, you know, some new story comes up that they're involved in. And you know them to be reliable, but then you look at their information in the current news story. Are they plugged in? Are they really getting information? And, you know, I know in the case of my source, that was a reliable source up to that point. And just bad information.
Well, John King, I've been a reporter for a long time, and I want to say I, too, have made many mistakes, serious mistakes, stupid mistakes, and often they've involved reporting in law enforcement issues when you are dealing with a lot of anonymous sources. So I have a great empathy for your situation because I've been there. But just one last thing I wanted to ask you about this before we move on. You also reported that the suspect was dark-skinned, and there's a lot of controversy about that as well. Why did you think that was relevant?
That's a great question. I thought it was relevant because I was told the investigation was moving very quickly at that point, and this was a different source. This was an elected official, a government official, and never in my career have I burned a source, and never in my career have I wanted more to burn a source, but I won't because I gave this source my word. And the source told me other information, which I refused to report, and I'm glad I didn't. But it was a misjudgment on my part. I was asked a question by one of our anchors, and I answered the question. The question was, you know, have any of your sources described when I was talking about the video breakthrough, have any of your sources described the suspect? And I answered the question, and I should not have done that. It added nothing helpful or useful to the conversation. It was done in the moment when you're, you know, moving through a story, and it was stupid, and it clearly, understandably, offended a lot of people. And I'm sorry for that.
John, moving on, but relevant to the marathon thing, there's a lot of congressional concern about the performance of the FBI after the questioning of the older brother in 2011. Added to the fact, why didn't they immediately check against their database as of 2:50 on Monday? Once they had the video and the pictures, why weren't they able to do some sort of a match to a guy they had questioned as well as his family in 2011? Where's that going, or is that going to be a 1 or 2 day wonder?
No, that's going to be a big deal. It's going to be a big deal anyway because, look, you know, you just have to. I know this will become political. There's already a political debate about, you know, a civilian trial, which the Obama administration says will happen, versus enemy combatants, which some people want to happen. So politics kicks into everything. So what are we going to have after the fact? Number one, let's hope that we have a smart, aggressive, disciplined prosecution. Number one, the people of Boston, the people of the United States deserve justice. And this suspect deserves due process. Some people won't like that I say that, but he does. And so let's have a disciplined prosecution, and then let justice be done. And if this young man is guilty, then he will face justice. You'll also have in Boston, you know, the police will have to go back and think, you know, is there anything different we can do when it comes to security before we run the marathon next year? And the FBI is going to have to go back. And let's assume the credibility of, you know, Bob Mueller, the FBI director, that he will do this himself. But you also have, welcome to Washington, you have a Republican House of Representatives that you can be sure will aggressively look into this.
John, you don't have to be a Republican. I know you mentioned the partisanship, and I think most of the criticism of the FBI, even though some of it's been withdrawn, has been from Republicans. You don't have to be a Republican to question what happened. Why did they? When you heard the story yesterday, the reason they didn't track him for his 6-month trip to Russia is because there was a misspelling of his name. You say to yourself, this is like the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Right. And so I didn't mean to suggest it was partisan. I just meant sometimes, you know, if we go back to things, like weapons of mass destruction, for example, when your party controls Congress, sometimes the oversight is not as aggressive as when the other party's around. But I think this is an American issue. It's not a partisan issue, that you do want to go back. And if mistakes were made, they were honest mistakes, then you find out how not to do them again. But I do think we need now to have full disclosure. And again, there's two tracks here. The urgent one is the investigation and the prosecution. But then, no, you know, it's less urgent, but it's important that they go back and say, all right, so what was the specific request from the Russian government? Was it maybe treated differently? Because sometimes we know President Putin does overhype, and he does persecute Chechens because of the civil, you know, strife within Russia. There are legitimate law enforcement questions within Russia, and there sometimes it becomes political on their end, too. Was it somehow discounted because of that? And then once they did have this file, did they just say, well, this is for the Russians, it has nothing to do with us, and did they stay on top of it? Those are all very legitimate questions, because if you had somebody who raised a flag, any kind of a flag, should they have, and then this gets into the whole civil liberties debate, should they have somehow kept him on, I'm going to say, use the word watch list, that has legal meaning in some places, should they have kept track of him somehow? That is a fair and legitimate debate, and it's a fair and legitimate question because of the specifics of this this suspect, now the deceased suspect, being questioned. And I think it's a very legitimate inquiry going forward.
One last question related to the marathon, and I'm going to ask the same question about whether this issue is a one-day wonder. I know people like Chuck Schumer, who was one of the Gang of Eight on the immigration reform proposal that was introduced last week, and of course virtually no one, at least in this part of the country, even knew that it had been filed. There are a number of opponents of this immigration reform appear to be trying to derail it using the issues relating to the Tsarnaev brothers. Is that a one-day thing, or does that have some staying power?
It's not a one-day thing. The staying power is a big question mark in the sense that, look, this is what knocked George W. Bush's immigration reform off the charts after 9/11. Remember, he wanted to, essentially have an open border with Mexico. He wanted to have path to citizenship. He wanted to have a new guest worker program. And the concern then was not that farm workers were going to come across illegally, but the terrorists would come across, whether either our southern border or our northern border. So we have, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, evidence that these concerns can knock immigration reform off the track. Now, I don't think the volume is as high. I don't think the temperature is as high as post 9/11. But what people are saying is very similar, essentially that, we have to be very careful here about who we allow into the country. In this case, I believe my memory is correct here, the suspect, still alive, the younger brother, was naturalized.
Yeah,
and the older brother had status. And so these are not people who were in the shadows. They had legal status. They had, they were either here permanently or here with legal status. Look, again, is it a legitimate question to raise in the immigration debate? How do we keep track of people? Who do we want to let into the country? Of course those are legitimate questions. Will there be some politics added to legitimate questions? Absolutely. Welcome to Washington. I'm not sure. Ask this question in 2 or 3 weeks. We'll see if the volume's turned down.
We're talking with John King, the chief national correspondent for CNN. John is going to be reporting tomorrow and Thursday from the Southern Methodist University in Dallas because the dedication of George W. Bush's, that's George II, of course, his presidential library is going to take place. So that's exciting enough. But you have an interview with President Bush and the First Lady that's going to air tomorrow night on Anderson Cooper's 360 at 10 o'clock. How was that?
It was very interesting. I actually had to go down to Texas in the middle of all the Boston stuff. And so it was interesting. And the president, I can say this, that the interview is embargoed, but his staff did say, whether you're a fan of George W. Bush or not, I asked him, being the commander-in-chief on 9/11, what he thought of when he heard the explosions at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. And what he told me is he said, it was a reminder to him that there's still evil out there. And he said, obviously, he mentioned the explosion, not terrorism, but the accident explosion in West Texas near his ranch in Crawford. And he said that he and Laura, but weeped and cried for the victims in both places. And he wanted to extend his best wishes. The library is very impressive. I say that not as a partisan statement, but they raise a lot of money, and it's a beautiful facility. And it's really interesting when you walk through it. You're in a room at first of it's education, it's kids' books, and it's a picture of the state dinner with the Mexican president at the time, Vicente Fox. That was on September 6, 2001, a reminder of what Bush wanted to do, what he wanted his presidency to be about, education reform and better relations within the hemisphere. And then you cross a threshold, and it's 9/11, and all the displays change to 9/11. And it sort of gives you a breathtaking reminder of how much that presidency changed on that September morning. And then you go through it, and there's a lot of controversy in there. You see pictures from 9/11, from Ground Zero, and then just steps away, there's pictures of Saddam Hussein and the statue coming down. And a lot of people will say, you can't connect those dots, obviously. A lot of people think that, the administration went to war in Iraq, used 9/11 as an excuse to go to war in Iraq. So just the political controversy is right there as well. And there's a library you can go into as a visitor. It's called Decision Points Library. And you can ask about Katrina, you can ask about Iraq, you can ask about anything else. And what it does is it brings up some of the memos and the policy positions people gave to the president at the time. And then you pick. And you pick, should we go to war in Iraq? What should we have done about Katrina? So it's an interesting thing. There's a lot of high technology there. And I talked to the president about this. I can't disclose the interview because it's on an embargoed basis. But I think people, whether you're a fan or not, will be interested in watching it. And he also discussed his post-presidency. You know, he's taken up painting.
I know.
We saw some of
he's
those.
He's pretty good.
Okay. I think you'll get a kick. I think you'll get a kick out of both he and Laura Bush talking about that, whether you're a fan or not. And one other quick thing about the library, it has an exact replica of the George W. Bush Oval Office. I spent 6 years covering the Bush presidency. I can tell you, when you step into that Oval Office, it's pretty eerie. It's exact.
That's great. Hey, so that's tomorrow night on Anderson Cooper, correct?
That's right. And then Thursday morning, there's a walk and talk through the library, a tour Mrs. Bush gave me, and that'll be on Thursday morning.
John, before you go away, somebody else took some heat for what they said in Boston last week, and I think you're going to settle the disagreement between me and Marjorie before you go. David Ortiz dropped an expletive in the outfield, and I thought it was one of the great organic moments in this past week. Marjorie thought it was crossed the line. Where are you on that?
Look, the man loves his city. Boston has been great to David Ortiz, and that was his passion coming out. And, you know, you don't ever want to drop the F-bomb, but understandable in this case is he, gave some love back to a city he knew was in pain at the moment.
Thank you for that,
okay,
John King.
Okay, I guess he's on Jim's side, unfortunately, John King, but that's okay.
Hey, John, we really appreciate coming on today and taking the heat. We really appreciate it, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday, John.
We'll see you next week. Take care, guys.
John King from CNN.
And CNN, by the way, has done spectacular coverage of the marathon in Boston. Our local TV stations have
can I just say one thing about this? You know how we often talk about the sincerity of an apology, and you can tell when it's real and it's not real?
Yep.
How would you judge that?
He's totally sincere.
Seven or eight first minutes with John King.
He made a mistake. It happens. It happens to all of us. And he owned up, and I don't think there's anything more you can ask. He's a great reporter and a great correspondent, and I love CNN. Anyway, that was John King, CNN's chief national correspondent. Question to you guys. Did security cameras that track the alleged marathon bombers make the case to amp up surveillance all around the city? The pros and cons of more eyes in the skies is next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Virtually everyone in America and millions throughout the world have obviously seen the video of the Tsarnaev brothers just before they allegedly planted the bombs, giving new momentum, I think, to the push for more surveillance cameras in our cities and forcing people to decide which matters more, security or privacy, or can we find a proper balance? In studio with us to discuss this is the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. That'd be Carol Rose. Hello, Carol.
Hi, nice to be here.
And the district attorney of Suffolk County, Dan Connolly. Good to see you, Dan.
Good to see you, Jim.
You know, before we get to the surveillance issue, you guys are both Bostonians. You've been around forever. I mean, this was a very difficult week for a lot of us. How was it for you?
Well, you know, on behalf of the ACLU, first of all, our hearts really go out to all the victims and the families. And we are as outraged and horrified as anyone else is and angry. And in fact, we're defiant in our defense of the freedoms that are now threatened because of this attack.
How about you as a human, though, Carol? We'll get to the ACLU. How did you react? You're a local person, though. How'd that hit you?
Well, I mean, I think like everybody else, there was fear and there was anger. And I think those are the two greatest emotions that people who do these kinds of attacks are trying to elicit in all of us. And I think that's why, as Americans, it's really important that we stand up for our democratic ideals, especially in the face of terror. We should not allow ourselves to be terrorized.
How about you, Dan Connolly? You're a local boy.
I left the finish line at about 2:30 that afternoon and was partly on the way home when I got the call from the police lieutenant assigned to my office to return to the scene. So I have to be totally candid with you. I was very shooken up by the whole thing, not only what I saw, but how close I was personally to having been a potential victim. And like Carol, my heart breaks for the victims. I just
do you
I
know
can't
people,
imagine.
Dan Connolly? Did you know people who were amongst the injured or any of the three people who lost their lives or not personally?
No, I did not know any one of the three people who lost their lives or anyone that was personally injured. But I was there at the crime scene at 3:12 when I arrived, and it's like nothing I'd ever seen before.
Yeah.
You know, Carol, Marjorie and I have debated for years this whole surveillance camera thing. I was a city councilor in Cambridge, where I think one of the few cities that refused federal money or in the last decade. And the other day we actually spoke to Michael Goldfarb. Is that his name? Yeah. From the Global Post, because we were talking about the London Marathon coming up. This is after last Monday. Here's what Goldfarb had to say to describe the situation in London. I read that the average person in London is captured on a television camera somewhere between 300 and 400 times a day. Is that accurate, or is that number going even higher?
Oh, yeah. One of the early stories I did for Global Post was a video piece showing all the cameras locally in my neighborhood. And, in fact, you know what they use the cameras for?
Mm. What?
Every once in a while I get a parking ticket in the mail because they caught me making an illegal turn on a Sunday morning. This is what they do. They hire out the cameras to the local councils, and it's a way for the councils to earn money. Yeah, you're right. 300 or 400 times a day seems about right.
So, Carol, is that where we're going in Boston, and why shouldn't we be going in that direction, whether we are or not?
Well, first I would say that the ACLU doesn't oppose surveillance cameras, certainly not at high-profile places. But I think people need to understand there's a difference between having a surveillance camera or any kind of law enforcement at a big public event like the Boston Marathon and thinking that suddenly putting surveillance cameras everywhere is actually going to enhance public safety. And I would suggest it actually would have the opposite effect.
Why?
Well, surveillance cameras can be useful. First of all, they don't deter high-profile attacks. They don't even deter most crimes. And every study from London and New York and every other place has shown that they actually don't keep us safe. To the extent that they can be help police to track down suspects after a crime has been committed, that can happen as long as you have the due process protections in place. You don't need to have total surveillance all the time of all people. And the potentials for abuse of total surveillance are great. So what we really need isn't to talk about technology, but actually is to talk about the legal protections that enable us to be both safe and free.
Well, Suffolk County DA Dan Connolly, people could certainly argue in this case that the surveillance cameras were preventative if you assume that these two brothers had plans to set off other explosions. And I know you want to expand them, so make your case.
Well, I think we're really behind the curve here in Boston when it comes to the publicly controlled CCTV system. New York, for example, and London, as was referenced to, they've been able to balance the civil liberties concerns. And I'm concerned about that as well. I don't want a police state here in Boston. But I will tell you that in today's modern criminal investigation, it's one of the very first things we do. But what we have to do, and what we did in this case just a few days ago, was literally knock on the doors of every business in the area and try to get them to agree to give us the video surveillance. Now, most of them do. Sometimes they don't. We've even had instances where business owners tamper with their own private security so they don't have to be involved. So this is
they don't have to be involved with law enforcement or because they've got something nefarious going on there?
Typically what'll happen is, again, we'll survey, knock on doors, and then you'll find we'll get to a scene and the hard drive will have already been removed, for example. This is what happened in Boston. Not that anyone tampered on Boylston Street, but we had to identify each and every business owner, get them to cooperate, download this video, and so forth. Imagine if we had our own publicly owned CCTV system. We would have had that information in real time, almost instantaneously. And at high-profile events like this, it is a deterrent, in my view. I can't see how it cannot be. If you're in Lower Manhattan, you see the signs all over the place. You are under surveillance by the New York City Police Department.
It's called the Ring of Steel, by the way. There are 3,000 cameras in Lower Manhattan, roughly 4,000 cameras in New York City on the subways. But, Carol, I have traditionally been totally with you on this issue. And then I'm looking at this video for the 5,000th time, like every single American, and you say to yourself, well, were it not for that surveillance video, whose ever it was, I don't even know whose store or business or whatever it was, these two guys might still be out, you know, creating terror in other communities or maybe more in Boston. So were you saying before, in that sort of setting, you're okay with it and the Civil Liberties Union is okay with it at major public events? Is the answer yes to that?
Well, what I would say is, yeah, when you have a major high-profile event, like this, the ACLU has never objected to having a surveillance camera at that kind of an event. But you'll notice it arguably even can attract a bomber. There's no place more heavily surveilled than the finish line of the Boston Marathon, okay? So it obviously didn't have a deterrent effect, and it didn't have a deterrent effect in London. It didn't have a deterrent effect in New York in Times Square.
But Marjorie said the point, and I tend to agree with her. So Ed Davis, the commissioner of police in Boston, is right, and these guys had enough ammunition to do it yet again. It didn't deter what they did at 2:50 on Monday, but by definition, it deterred whatever plans they had prospectively, no?
Well, to the extent that it goes after people who've already committed a crime, I already said, I think that there are ways that you can have that kind of surveillance camera work. But what we need to be sure is that we have the due process protections, the checks and balances in place so that there's a criminal nexus. What we don't want to do is move to a system where we have cameras everywhere, and we don't have the due process protections of a warrant requirement or an emergency, you could waive it. But on a day-to-day basis, you don't want people to be surveilled when they're going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, when they're going to visit their mental health doctor, when they're going, in their day-to-day activities. And you have to have legal protections in place to make sure that people's rights aren't abused, and at the same time that law enforcement has the tools that it needs. And I would suggest that for the most part, we've seen from this incident that law enforcement did have the tools that it needed because they found the perpetrators. And to the extent that they need more, I think as long as we have due process protections in place, at these high-profile events, I think that's fine.
How do you respond to that, Dan Conway?
Not fast enough as far as I'm concerned. And you might say, well, that's kind of silly. It took only a couple of days to get this, but it could have been within an hour or less if we had our own publicly owned CCTV system.
To read Tom Kane's piece, did you serve on the city council?
I did, yes.
Tom Kane's got a piece in the Globe today in which he says something not dissimilar from what Carol Rose says. There have to be precautions. For example, and I'm paraphrasing, and I know one of you will correct me if I'm wrong. One of the things he said is this stuff should not be available to the public. Whatever freedom of information laws exist about getting access to either 911 tapes or photographs, then build in some statutory protection so that when the person's going to the mental health place or wherever they're going, the only people that see that video are law enforcement people. Would you be okay with that?
I absolutely would. I've been talking about this, expanding this CCTV system publicly owned and operated by the police and the city of Boston for a while now, with Mayor Menino, with Commissioner Davis and Paul McMillan, who's the chief of police. I wrote to the mayor recently, Sunday to be exact, about creating a working group to kind of discuss the kind of things you talk about. Let's figure out how we protect ourselves against potential terrorists like we had on Monday, but balance the civil liberties. And I would actually invite and ask that Carol and her group and others participate in that sort of working group so that we can balance the equities, if you will, and come up with a system that protects us, takes advantage of the technology that can do so, but also balances our civil liberties.
Well, Carol Rose from the ACLU, what about that kind of compromise situation where not in front of the mental health facility, although many of those are located in big apartment buildings that already have, or big medical buildings that already have that kind of surveillance, but a compromise between the two? There was a case in Brookline, corner of Beacon Street and Harvard Street, a couple of years ago, where a surveillance camera there spotted rapists who had pulled a woman basically into a car and a truck and driven off with her, and they caught those guys. I thought that was terrific. You don't want to have them everywhere, but a compromise.
Right. No, I actually think that there are ways to achieve it. That's why I think it's sort of a false dichotomy to say privacy versus security. I actually think it's both possible to have both. To the extent, for example, that you might have a surveillance camera in a high crime area that catches a perpetrator, that's fine. But you don't need to hold those tapes indefinitely. The concerns that we have are when surveillance is used, for example, to surveil people for their protected political speech. For example, recently there was a surveillance video taken of people who are anti-war protesters, and they were put into a criminal database. We have to take steps to make sure that when there is no criminal nexus, the people's images aren't merely rounded up and put into criminal databases. Why, for example, should all the people who cross the finish line at the Boston Marathon go into a criminal database? What you want to do is
I may interrupt, can't imagine anybody, whether it's a Suffolk County DA or the most strident pro-surveillance camera person, saying that they want the picture of somebody going to a mental health facility or crossing the marathon line to go into a criminal database.
Actually, Jim, that's already happening in two ways.
I'm not saying it's not happening. Well, I'm just saying, but nobody, everybody, I assume, would be willing to buy into statutory language that protects. See, my concern to
the FBI would not right now. They're actually trying to create a permanent database on every human being, and so that's where we don't want to go in that direction, because when we do, we become a repressive society, just like the ones that we don't like.
Can I interrupt? Only I want to ask Stan Connolly about the statutory thing. Marjorie and I used to fight all the time about this, the TSA security, and not only the full body searches, but the photographs and the de facto naked photographs. One of the promises that was made by the people who manufactured these $250,000 machines is the photograph is immediately gone. It's not stored. And then we found out, of course, it's stored.
It's not.
So even if all this language, let's assume she drafted the language, Carol Rose from the Civil Liberties Union. Dan Connolly, either the DA or the mayor, whatever you are, in a year, signs off on this thing. How is a member of the public supposed to have any trust that law enforcement officials, whether with all due respect, a DA, an FBI, are going to honor what they've told us publicly? Because there's so many examples of statutory language being violated. And then we hear after the fact, well, we did it for your own security. How do you protect against that?
Again, I think people of goodwill can come to a compromise situation that balances the equities reasonably. It could be, for example, some sort of a commission that supervises the equipment to make sure that these things aren't being kept. The equipment that I'm most familiar with, privately owned generally, it depends on how sophisticated it is, but generally eats its tail, meaning that after 30 minutes or 30 days or a week, it's gone. It's taped over, because that's the way these systems work. We could have something like that in place. So it's gone, disappeared, but it could be supervised and monitored by some sort of a commission or group. But I think we're really missing out on a tremendous opportunity to protect our citizens. And instead of relying on private citizens, who, by the way, I wouldn't give these terrorists the kind of credit that that some people might think they had, like they knew they were on tape. They probably didn't. I was down there for 2 hours, and it never occurred to me, knowing what I know as the chief law enforcement officer in Suffolk County, that I was videotaped.
Well, so if they're dumb
times.
Enough to stick around for several days, I don't think anybody's going to give them credit for doing anything well except planning to kill people, and that's about
right,
the
extent. Right, which is one of the reasons they're not good deterrents.
Let me just ask you one other thing, though, besides the cameras, because I found this a little disturbing, and I'd like input from both of you on this. I've seen a lot of videos, YouTube, online, of the Watertown house-to-house searches, and it was pretty scary, where you see armed police officers with big, huge rifles banging on the doors, and then homeowners coming out with their hands up and sometimes in bare feet with carrying their children running down the street. I get it. The second younger brother was hiding somewhere in Watertown, as we know. But what did you make of that, Carol Rose, as someone from the ACLU?
Well, the ACLU is incredibly concerned, and we are trying to, if people feel that their rights were violated, we certainly want to hear about it. But we're really also concerned about making sure we get all of the facts first, because it's tough to second guess. There was somebody who was throwing grenades out their car and shooting
exactly.
at people, and
yep.
you don't know if they were holding some family hostage. So we don't know. It's hard to second guess the police. Monday morning, it's a little easier than it is at the time. At the same time, we're now trying to gather the information to find out what really happened. And to the extent that people's rights were violated, the ACLU wants to hear about it. And we want to talk to law enforcement to make sure that that doesn't happen again. Because there are lots of scary criminal events that happen, sadly, in our society. And we want to make sure that as Americans, we don't easily sacrifice our individual rights and liberties out of fear.
Dan, we know
Suffolk
you only
County.
Have a minute or two. You were kind enough to
yeah.
share. But what's your take on this?
Yeah, I was a president in Watertown. I haven't heard of any situations where people felt terribly victimized or traumatized. I think the police were trying actually to protect people. This was a very dangerous individual, heavily armed, who was capable of great violence, and I think the police were given some amount of leeway. But if there was egregious conduct by any members of the police, I'm sure it'll be handled with and dealt with fairly.
Yeah, the way this sounds so far, he wants you, Carol Rose, on his commission, and I think you should appoint him to your board of directors based upon what he said. Can we strike that deal right here? Carol Rose.
Carol and I have always had a good relationship, and she's very reasonable, and I hope she feels that I am too. But I think that the time has come. These cameras aren't going to eliminate crime. I think we can all agree on that. We all know that. But it's just like not passing reasonable gun control legislation by the argument saying, oh, this isn't going to save another life or prevent a new time. I think it will. It will do some. It's not going to eliminate it, but it's something we should take advantage of.
He is Dan Connolly. He is the Suffolk County DA. Carl Rose is the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Gentlemen and lady, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Good to see you both.
Thank you.
We're going to debate this with you guys now at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. We're going to open up the lines when we come back and ask what you think about increasing surveillance cameras in the wake of the Boston Marathon tragedy. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Boston has been through a lot in the past week. That's why WGBH is inviting you to join us tomorrow night at our studios in Brighton for the Taste of WGBH History of Beer event. It's your chance to raise a glass to the city that gave us the first brewery in America, Sam Adams himself, and the American Revolution, while sampling some surprising brews from days gone by. Tickets are $35 with a discount for members. Visit wgbh.org/events for more.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Zeitarian Theater, proudly presenting Oscar-winning actress Olympia Dukakis in a tour de force performance of Rose, Saturday, April 27th. Tickets and more information available at Zeitarian.org. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she's Marjorie. And you just heard from Carl Rose from the Civil Liberties Union. You heard from Dan Connolly, candidate for mayor, but he was not here for that reason. He was here because he's Suffolk County DA debating. And actually, it wasn't that much of a disagreement about the expansion of surveillance cameras in light of what we saw on them. I guess it was last Thursday night at about 5 o'clock. And we want to know which side you are on. If you're against expansion of them, why? And if you're for expansion, what kind of protections do you want built in, like some of the ones that were just discussed by Connolly and Rose? You know, Marjorie, you know what's most interesting to me?
What?
If you read stories in the last 48 hours, as I know you have, about expansion of surveillance cameras, I assume there'd be a rush in Congress, unlike on guns or anything else, to actually do something here to expand them. I am stunned that there's bipartisan concern, as there should be, about privacy rights, about some of the stuff that Carol Rose and Dan Connolly were talking about. So it seems to me I was wrong. I assumed there'd be a rush to expand them practically overnight, and it appears it's a little more thoughtful than I gave people credit for.
Well, I also think that people are just much more used to being photographed in public, whether you want to be or not. Everybody's got a cell phone now with cameras. I mean, you're out.
It's not government. That's
it's
a big
not,
difference.
It's not government, but look at what happened after this. You had everybody handing over their own private iPad photographs or their camera photographs or their smartphone photographs. You had a lot of people rushing in to do this. So one of the ironies, of course, here is that these two young men didn't make much of an effort to disguise themselves. You know,
one of them, I don't know.
He had a baseball cap on, the older brother,
and
sunglasses on, but it wasn't, you know, you might think you might put a hood on, you might grow a beard, you might have some kind of a little bit more of a thoughtful disguise. And as Tom Keene points out this morning in his piece in the Globe, you could do these things at night, and then it would be a lot more difficult to identify anybody, whether you had a surveillance camera or not. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
Before we get to the calls, are you
going to give the email address?
Oh, I'm sorry, sure.
bpr@wgbh.org. Yes, Jim.
Your historical position has been, and I'll paraphrase, and then you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the more the better. If you're out in public, you have no expectation of privacy. You don't really feel like they can film you anywhere. If you're out in public, they're not filming you in your house, theoretically. They're not filming. You lose your expectation of privacy when you go down the street. Because I don't buy that at all, by the way.
I don't buy lose your expectation of privacy when you go down the street. But if you're in a major intersection, if you're on, you know, on Commonwealth Avenue in downtown Boston or on Harvard Street in Brookline or on Mass Ave in Cambridge, you are out in the public. So I guess I know that having cameras in those very busy public places doesn't bother me.
You're not concerned about some of the stuff Carol Rose mentioned at the top of our discussion about putting all that being shoved into some database and saved? I liked when I heard Dan Connolly say some of these machines are built in such a way that it automatically destructs the video or the photo.
I think
I'm not as trusting as you are.
I think some people have delusions of grandeur when it comes to – it's like being on Nixon's enemies list. You know, you think that that the FBI is going to be listening to your telephone and going to be following you around. And I think 99% of us, Jim, don't have to worry about those sorts of things,
something?
Including you. I know this disappoints you because there's something in you that wants to be on these lists.
Well, can I tell you a quick story before we get to the calls? Uh-huh. When I was in law school, I started law school at NYU. What everybody did, all my friends – we immediately put in an Freedom of Information request for our FBI records because that was what was cool. I'm the only one who didn't. You know why I didn't?
Because you weren't going to be on the record.
I was afraid I wouldn't have one.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. 877-301-8970. What do you feel about what I assume is going to be some push, whether it's a moderate one like Dan Conley talked or more severe in the wake of last Thursday's videos, released last Thursday of the two alleged mass murderers. Let's start in Milford, New Hampshire, where Irene is on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling, Irene.
Hi. I'm completely against this idea of expanded video of any kind.
Why is that?
Well, I live most of the year in Belgium, and they don't allow that in Belgium, in my town or any of the towns near mine. And I just see there are no protections. Time and time again, we see all these things come to light that the government has infringed on our privacy, and I'm sorry, there's just no protection against it, and it's just ridiculous. The idea is ridiculous, and if you look at it, the pictures that were happening at this event, there were tons of pictures being snapped. Now, how is that, you know, they could have done it just the same with all the pictures that people were sending.
You mean from private people and businesses? And obviously the video that we all saw was not, I don't believe, a government video, but rather some business surveillance system. So your view is you're not troubled if people in the private sector are doing it. You just don't want government doing it. Is that where you are?
That's correct, yes.
Okay,
Irene, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Steve from Burlington. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hey, guys. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Long
time no talk to you guys.
Good to talk to you too,
I
Steve.
I have no problem if they want to put cameras anywhere they want. But on the flip side, let's put cameras in every single police cruiser angling inwards. Let's put cameras in all the state house hallways. Let's put cameras in the parking garage in the state house so we can see these state reps coming and going so they don't lie to us. So if they do that, then I have no problem for them watching what we're doing.
That's a good idea.
I might be willing to cut that deal too, Steve. Actually.
I hear there's a lot of shady stuff going on in the state house garage. That's my information.
On the state house, they're not telling us who's coming and going in the parking garage.
Yeah.
Why can't we put cameras? It's a public place.
Didn't the Herald ask that? Wasn't the Herald doing some
we
sort
tried.
Of story on
we
that?
We were outside of the State House garage with a camera photographing people coming in and coming out. And Hillary Chabot was the stalwart reporter. You know what happened?
No.
State trooper said to get herself and her little camera.
Hey, they're no dopes.
Excuse me, it may have been a State House police officer, but a law enforcement official said, move it.
You know what I'm really glad you haven't done so far?
What? If
you,
talked that, about that, your slithering,
no, well,
Jim?
Well, I know that's going to come
that's
up.
That's why Jim doesn't
but
like
that
this.
Tired argument that if you have nothing to hide, then why are you against this kind of thing? Well, because there is a line. There is a, I hate to use the tired old expression, there is a big brotherish kind of thing. When I read, we were talking about that Goldfarb guy from the Global Post, we played it a few minutes ago, who was talking about being photographed hundreds of times a day. You go to London, which is a wonderful city, and everywhere you are, there's a camera on a post at a corner. That doesn't bother you?
But you know what I find pretty disturbing? Many other things are already public, like 911 calls. That's why we can hear some of these horribly grueling, upsetting 911 calls make when some tragedy has happened in somebody's house. Someone's been shot or murdered or whatever it is. And I did not know until this morning that whether your house is protected by security systems can be found out online.
You mean the Tom Kane
yes,
piece?
Yes, Tom Kane piece. I found that very disturbing. So you know whether you had protection or whether you didn't have protection. Those sorts of things are a little bit scary to me that anybody can get that kind of information online.
But by the way, it's interesting. Dan Conley, again, the Suffolk County DA, agreed with the piece in Kane's column that if we do expand these surveillance cameras, there be laws put in place, which hopefully will be honored, and hopefully is the critical word, that the stuff is not publicly available. Obviously, it's purely for the police, but then the question comes, while we all are in this flush of good feeling for the police, and well, we should, you know, in normal times, a lot of people worry about what's going to happen to this stuff and does it get leaked out. Let's go to Watertown. Watertown, of all places. Watertown Strong is the new T-shirt, say, and Lola's on Boston Public Radio. Hello there, Lola.
It's Lorna.
Oh, Lorna. I'm very sorry, Lorna. Good to talk to you.
Right. Well, I was just going to say two things. One, on the CCTV.
Yeah.
I would much rather have properly regulated CCTV in the hands of the police than to have private CCTV where they can do with it what they want in a completely unregulated way.
Mm-hmm.
My second point was I was part of the house-to-house police search, and, you know, several state policemen came in a very impressive vehicle. They were very polite, not in the slightest bit threatening. My 7-year-old grandson was delighted.
That's good.
So I don't think that, well, my experience of them was certainly not bad. But I'm very interested in your comment about the private CCTV, which is unregulated, versus a potentially well-regulated public CCTV.
Well, it's a wonderful point, which I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't thought much about. I was, you know, I'm worried about the, as I said, the big brotherish part of this public thing. But the point I guess you're making is that at least we have some ability to try to control what public cameras do and don't do and what's used with that. And we have virtually no power over private surveillance. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
That's good. I mean, that is a legitimate issue. It is a truly legitimate issue. And I'm assuming, I should know this, that they are subject to laws as well. But I'm assuming until there's an abuse that's made public, it's pretty hard to police such things. So let's find out what other people think. Lorna, thank you for your call. It's an excellent point.
You know, I'm getting an email. By the way, the emails are running about 50-50 for more cameras and no more cameras. Mm-hmm. But from an IT professional who says DA Dan Connolly was talking about videotape eating its tail, but that the cameras now are digital. And as an IT professional, this emailer says failures can be recovered, you know, and there are backups and replications and so forth. So even if you delete something, you can get a backup. So I am hardly an IT professional. But it does seem as though once something is online, once something is in a digital form, once something is posted.
I don't think it's going to be online or posted, but even recorded, you're talking
recorded.
About. Once it's recorded. But, you know, as he said, let Carol Rose and the Civil Liberties Union be on. I'm willing for at least to have them have that discussion. But I worry about databases, not for the reasons you think. I'm not slithering anywhere, Marjorie.
Jim is slithering.
I'm not.
Actually, he's a well-known slitherer.
No, I am not. I'm not, but someday I may grow up to be. Let's go to Norwood, where Greg is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for your call, Greg.
Hi. So recently I took the kids to Disney World. Do you know you have to offer a fingerprint to get into Disney World to use with the card that you buy?
No, you do not. They take a fingerprint?
I was the single individual who asked why, and then I became that dad. You know what I mean?
And what is their answer? When you ask them why, Greg, what's the argument as to whether or not just showing your license is not enough ID? What do they say?
And of course it's some guy in some kind of like nice little, you know, fluffy outfit polished to the nines. And he said, oh, no, sir, everything's fine. As soon as you're through using your card, we swipe your fingerprint clean. And you know that's not true.
Now, Greg, before you, we're losing you because you have a horrible connection. Very quickly, did you ultimately say yes because you had no choice?
No, I was not bad. We had to go in a separate line with the rest of the people who have brain.
Greg, thank you thank you.
That's pretty scary.
Well, that is really scary and ridiculous. Can you come up with a reason why they need a fingerprint as opposed to a photo ID?
They run a pretty tight shop down there at Disney World and Disneyland, you know, in California and down in Florida. So I was thrown out of there once because this was in the 80s for wearing gym shorts.
Well, also, do you know for years you couldn't have a beard if you were? I mean, they're pretty tight. They run a very tight ship.
And those were the times when people used to smoke.
Yeah.
And they would come out with a little dustpan and brushes and they'd sweep up all the cigarettes. It was a very tight ship situation out there. Barbara from Cape Cod, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi, Barbara.
First of all, it's the first time I've ever called a radio station, so I'm a little nervous.
Don't be nervous.
My son was at the finish line, and he was beaten up a little bit and spent the night in Beth Israel's hospital, so I'm right on top of all of this.
Well, before you go ahead, Barbara, when you said beaten, what do you mean? What happened to him exactly?
His leg, one leg. It wasn't shrapnel. It was just debris, dirt and rocks and glass. And he had it all bandaged from his hip down to his toes, and his face was cut up a little bit.
How is he now? How is he?
He's good. He's good. He only spent one night in the hospital. He almost took his 9-year-old daughter, but she said that, so that's my granddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, nope, she had a friend that was coming over, and she'd like to play with a friend.
Good. Good.
So anyway, what I was going to say was, this morning I went to the dentist, and the receptionist took my picture. And asked me if it was okay. And I said, okay. And then I went to a prestigious little toy store to get a toy for said granddaughter. And they took my picture at the entrance of the store and then asked me afterward if it was okay. And I said, it's okay.
Wait a minute. Was it the camera they took your picture, or was there just an ongoing camera up in the ceiling somewhere?
No. It was a little camera. I don't know. I'm not too good at these things, but it was... Both of them were little cameras, and the receptionist snapped the picture.
And what's the rationale for either? Did you ask?
No.
With resignation in her voice, she says.
Wow.
I just didn't ask. I mean, I'm upset about the whole thing, and I don't know what the answers are, but I was taken aback by both of these little...
So would I be.
Yeah.
Hey, Barbara, we're really glad you're kid as well. Stay in touch with us, and thank you. It was a great first call for you to public radio. Thanks, Barbara.
Now, that's an experience that would upset me.
Would you let him do it?
No.
Good. You had to think for a second, didn't you?
Well, you have to get your makeup on and fix your hair and those kinds of things.
You know, I hate the expression slippery slope, but let me use it here anyway because I can't think of one clear. That's the problem. When you have a mentality that we're in a surveillance society, then all of a sudden, well, do it at the dentist office. Do it at the toy store. What possible rationale is there for those kinds of service providers to have a picture of you?
Well, that's I've never heard of that happening. Maybe it's happening on Cape Cod, but I've not had that experience of you.
Well, you hang out on Cape Cod. You ever had your picture taken?
No, I have not.
What's the name of that ice cream joint you go to?
Four C's.
Well, next time you go to Four C's, right, before you get the chocolate mint chip, Marjorie, they're going to take your picture front and back. Let's go to Jennifer and Quincy. You're next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Jennifer. We're talking about the expansion of surveillance cameras, and my assumption, there's going to be a major push for that in the wake of the videos we saw last Thursday. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hi, it's great to hear you guys, by the way.
Thank you. We're glad
to be
here.
Thank you, Jennifer.
I have a couple points. The first point is I am for the closed circuit television because I think all the parking lots, department stores were already monitored anyway. I don't think it makes any big of a difference. If we did have the surveillance on the streets of Boston and didn't have to rely on the citizens, perhaps Sean Collier would be with us right now. Collier.
He's the MIT police officer, yep. For those who don't remember the name, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
And also, I think that perhaps maybe some children and families in Watertown would not have been terrorized. But I also feel that this was an unprecedented event. And to form any type of opinion on what we should and should not have done really has no value. I think that the Boston Police Department and everybody involved should be very proud of what they did. And I that's how I feel about it. I'm very proud to be from this city.
Jennifer, nicely put. Thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, you know, that's the hope, obviously, that it is an unprecedented event. But there are many people, you read these stories, pretty depressing stories, talking about that this sort of small explosive, which does a lot of damage, they raised the number of injured people now in the Boston Marathon up over 200. I think it's 264.
280-something.
280-something. Yeah. Yes, that this is going to become increasingly common. I certainly hope they're wrong and that it's not going to become increasingly common, but I think people that are experts in the terrorism field fear this kind of thing. Let's go to Sean from Dedham. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Sean. Let's put Sean on hold. Let's go to Tom in the car. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hello there, Tom.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
Well, I was calling and saying that the district attorney said that most of these devices write over each other themselves after a certain period of time. That's correct. But before they write over, the people in control of the device can, in fact, copy it and send it around if they have access to the network. And so I think if you're going to do that, that's fine. There's obviously legitimate reasons for it. But if you want to have something like that, then there should be some kind of a journal kept sent to an independent agency so that you can then, in fact, audit whether who copied the device, who sent the information around, and whether it was appropriate or not.
Well, you know, just for Boston, only speaking for Boston, when Dan Connolly talked about some oversight body, he actually suggested right here that the Civil Liberties Union be part of that thing. And I have to say, if they expand it and if the concerns you voice are real, and I think they are totally legit.
They are real. I've overseen these things.
I'm not quarreling with you at all. Okay. I share your concerns. Then the answer is let's make sure somebody like Carol, the generic Carol in this case, is on top of it. Thank you hugely for your call, Tom. We appreciate it.
You know, there is something to consider here. We're all worried about the government overstepping its bounds in terms of having lists and surveillance and so forth. In this case, we had the older brother, Tamerlan, who was highlighted by the Russian government, and we were warned about him, and the FBI was told about him, and yet the picture was out there in the public, and law enforcement did not seem to know who it was for quite some time.
And the assumption is based on their interview in 2011, right. They had a photograph of him somewhere in their database because they questioned him and his family after the Russian government suggested they take a look at him.
And remember the so-called underpants bomber that
yes,
was also known to authorities, as they put it, and he wasn't seemed to stop. So sometimes I think maybe the problem is not of they're acting too aggressively on innocent people. It's not acting aggressively enough on people they have concerns about. Anyway, speaking of being watched 24/7, there's two people whom no one was watching last night. They are, of course, Congressman Steve Lynch and Congressman Ed Markey, who debated. We finally found someone who did see their debate last night. We're going to tell you about it next on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
When news happens, it happens to all of us. You live here, you work here, and we do too. So when news happens, we're here to keep you connected to information and to each other. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Welch & Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch & Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com. And Gardner Mattress, specializing in handmade, lace tufted, and custom-made mattresses. Handcrafted wood bed frames on display also. Celebrating 80 years, located in Salem, Woburn, and Newton. GardnerMattress.com.
Last night, we listened to Boston Public Radio, by the way, with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Last night, John Keller did a terrific job moderating a Democratic Senate primary debate. Here's one. Steve Lynch was on the attack the whole night. Here is one of Steve Lynch's more memorable lines.
On fishing rights, I'm with the fishermen, you're with the fish.
I'm with the fishermen, and I don't even know what it means, but it was a good line. You know, we spent a ton of time today calling all the usual suspects, and sadly, some might argue irresponsibly, virtually no one, including Marjorie and I, watched the debate. But one of our colleagues did, with the aid of recorded sound and the thoroughly responsible Peter Kadzis, and you, we hope. If you saw it, you can call us, 877-301-8970. We're going to attempt to review last night's contentious Democratic debate, because there are only 7 days to go till the primary. Hello, Peter Kadzis.
Well, this tells me at least one thing. I need to get a life.
Well, maybe you do. No, but we're just
Allison King, your colleague Allison King. She on my Twitter feed. No one else was on, but Allison King was on.
You know, by the way, I wasn't making that up. We literally called almost every political person we ordinarily have on the show. I guess one had seen the debate but couldn't come in, and then thank God Peter showed up at work.
It's the marathon. I mean, people that we called this morning, one of them confessed that she was out having a well-needed dinner out and relaxation, a couple of cocktails with her friends, because the stress of the race has been, its aftermath, obviously, has been just overwhelming.
So I read the Globe account. I saw Allison King. Give us the short for what did we miss, Peter Kadzis?
Well, there's no doubt that Lynch won. And the reason Lynch won is that Markey has a 37-year record, and as a result, there's a lot of wrinkles that Lynch could chew at. And Lynch was very skillful at picking at the sort of dangling chads, the loose chads of Markey's record. And I'll tell you, when you look at the press releases that Markey sent out to rebut the debate.
They do them during the debates. For those who don't know, if you're a reporter,
it's incredible.
Unlike Lynch, who does not do it during a debate, I don't know how many he did last night. Markey's campaign usually sends out 6, 7, 8 emails during the debate, either rebutting something that Lynch said or reinforcing
That's
something
That's how I knew
said.
There was a debate, Jim, because my email was jammed.
The Markey campaign sent out 10, by the way, very good and very persuasive emails, but, you know, 10 defending Markey's record and 3 more, you know, whacking Lynch's. Mm-hmm. So even by the energetic standards of the Markey campaign, they were
they outdid themselves, yeah.
Yeah, but
it started with the Homeland Security stuff, obviously off the Boston Marathon, right? And Lynch is, well, actually, let's hear. Can we hear one bite here? This is Congressman Lynch putting Congressman Markey, I think you'll agree, on the defensive. They were talking about, well, you'll hear. He's contending that Markey was one of 2 congressional members who opposed port security legislation. Listen to this.
Every single member of Congress, Democrat and Republican, that supported funding for Homeland Security, that supported having a coordinated effort between federal, state, and local officials, we all voted for that. You voted against it, and somehow you're the champion because you voted against the bill to create
that. I'll tell you this, Steve.
If
I did vote no, the reason I voted no was that they were excluding a provision that would have made the bill even stronger.
How powerful was that when you're watching this thing?
I'll tell you, it was very powerful when you watched it. But when I went back and checked the record, I actually found that Markey was correct. I mean, Markey is somewhat famous in Washington circles for one time carrying on a long tutorial on port security to a totally empty chamber with only the cameras going, and he had models and maps and I really like Lynch, and I'm usually in the position of defending Lynch against other people attacking him, but Markey's record on port security is excellent.
Yeah, but fairly or unfairly, Peter, I would say not only are you one of 3 people who watched this debate, you're probably the only person who went back and researched who was right on this thing. When you hear the sound, it seems to me that Lynch did a pretty good job.
And
I'm sort of surprised.
Lynch did an excellent job.
Yeah. But what's interesting.
And it was a turnaround, by the way.
What do you
because
mean?
In the Herald debate, I thought it was a draw. Most everybody else thought Markey prevailed in the Herald debate, which was much more collegial and polite than this debate last night.
You know, by the way, if you're one of very few people who did see this thing, and I, from the clips I've seen, John Keller did yet another great job. Give us a buzz and you can add to Peter's voice, 877-301-8970. But Peter Kadzis, before you continue, the first thing I thought of, I'm going to repeat Markey's words. Let me ask you what you think of from this campaign. If I did vote no, well, that was sort of a weird line, if I did vote no, but if I voted no, quote, the reason I voted no is because they were excluding a provision that would have made the bill stronger. What does that sound like from earlier in this campaign?
Ooh.
It sounds like
it sounds
Steve
like
Lynch
Steve
saying
Lynch,
the
yes,
reason I voted against Obamacare
yes,
is because it was a giveaway to the insurance companies and I wanted stronger provisions.
No, you're 100% right. I was a little slow on the uptake there.
I was trying to help you out.
But you helped me out by rubbing my nose in it. But that's okay. That's okay.
Very nasty of you, Jim.
It was. No, I apologize.
No.
Go ahead.
These are very complicated issues. And I think that the whole Democratic establishment is really arrayed against Lynch, who is a bit of a maverick. Lynch isn't a huge maverick. I mean, listen, if this were Kansas, Lynch would be a communist.
Yeah, exactly.
But Lynch is a bit of a maverick. He is a bit of an independent thinker. And I think he is unfairly held to a standard that Markey's not held to. In this regard.
Why is the entire Democratic establishment arrayed against Steve Lynch from South Boston?
Well, it's not. I don't think they're arrayed against Lynch. They're arrayed in favor of Markey.
Well, okay, then why?
They wanted to clear the field so that there's no war, intra-Democratic Party war, so that a Democrat who happened to be Markey succeeds John Kerry. Isn't that what it was all about?
Exactly. The Hollywood money, as David Bernstein reported in his blog today. David Geffen, Julie Andrews, you know, many other famous left coast people contributing. It's because establishments like winners. I mean, that's why it's not a moral. The establishment likes a winner, and Markey is the front runner in this race.
So give us another. We talked about the Homeland Security piece where I think the consensus is, despite your research, Lynch scored some points. Where else? Because the consensus
Lynch got a very good point in speaking directly to the viewers and listeners in Western Massachusetts.
Oh, I love this.
When he talked about, the big communication industries hurting the consumer.
And by the way, the reason that matters for those who haven't been following this campaign, Ed Markey is generally seen as Mr. Telecommunications. And here's part of that exchange from last night. First voice, Steve Lynch. Second voice, Ed Markey. Here it is.
In your telecommunications bill, you promised the people that we'll have a diversity of companies out there, a diversity of democracy and media. We don't have that. We have two companies that control the whole market. The poor people in Western Mass, they're watching the Yankees tonight. They don't have broadband. Talk to the people in Pittsfield about how their telecommunication. There are companies that won't go out there and locate jobs because they don't have any broadband access.
Steve is putting so many red herrings out here. We're going to have to put an aquarium right here in the middle of the studio, John.
Not a bad line. But, you know, you know what this reminds me of? Lynch in the earlier debates, I thought it's been fine, but not on fire. It's almost like Barack Obama in the first debate when he slept through the thing. And then all of a sudden he decided that he was going to fight. You know, this is essentially who Lynch, the persona that Lynch wants the voters to see, isn't it? The fighting, scrappy, former iron worker against what he would call the lifer, right? The guy who lives in Washington, who is a creature of Congress. Isn't that his whole goal?
Well, that is his goal, and there's a strategic goal here, because even though Markey is up 10 points in the most recent poll, 40% of the electorate, the potential electorate, is still undecided.
Well, the thing is, though, if no one watched the debate, now maybe members of the general public watched the debate, just our usual political analysts didn't watch the debate, but if no one watches the debate, Markey's got much more money. Is this just, you know, the old tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it tale?
Oh, you just want to squelch this whole conversation. You spoil sport.
I'm sorry. But you do wonder.
I think
Lynch can make commercials out of this. And by the way, Lynch has had very good commercials.
That I Am Steve Lynch. Those commercials are fabulous.
And he does have a great story. And I like the maverick thing about Steve Lynch. But you do wonder, will this have any impact at all, Peter Katsas?
Well, people listening to this show may go back. You can go on the WCVB website and, you know, you can watch the debate.
Other than
again.
The fact that it wasn't on WCVB, it'd be easy to watch it. It was done on WBZ.
Oh, well. Shame
Keller.
On me. Shame on me.
Maybe that's why people are missing this thing. But, you know, let me say, you know, Markey is running a totally different campaign for obvious reasons. He doesn't have that passion. But, you know, Steve Lynch, I asked him this question, then he was asked in an earlier debate, what's your greatest accomplishment? It's not like he's a new kid in Congress. He's been there
12 years.
Whatever. His response was, and it's not insignificant, is he worked really hard to save the three veterans hospitals.
Yeah.
That was the first thing that Ted Kennedy said to him in his swearing in, you should work for. Markey, whether you like him or not, really has quite a congressional resume. And
it's
you may
huge.
Say 36 years is too much. That's one point of view. Another point of view is amongst House members, the guy has done a lot in Congress. Is that not a fair characterization?
In addition to harbor security, he is probably the leading champion for internet access. He's very vocal on nuclear safety. He is, despite the zing that Lynch got in on him, very big on curbing the excess of mega monopolies in general. No, he has a very solid record.
So what's he done to the fishermen? Steve Lynch enabled Lynch to say that Markey was with the fishermen, was
with
the fish, rather, while Lynch
fish.
Is with the fishermen. One of his best lines of the night.
Well, it's because Markey upholds the restrictions on fishing.
Fishing limits.
And Lynch doesn't.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And this is one of those really complicated issues about the people making a livelihood now, will there be a livelihood in the future?
Of course, the big problem also for Lynch is that in these primary races, it's a lot of the most loyal Democrats that vote, and a lot of the most loyal Democrats tend to be a little bit left of center, more left of center than the average Democrat who comes out on Election Day.
Well, the flip side of that, though, is even though he didn't get the endorsement of the AFL-CIO, he's got a lot of unions on his side. Lynch does. I mean, Markey has some of the bigger ones, too, and they tend to turn out in these elections. Yeah, the crime, you know, on one hand, I always forget until I read it in the paper, Steve Lynch won his primary in, what was it, 12 years ago on September 11th. And so, you know, talk about horrible timing for an election. And then we had a debate. Marjorie and I were disagreeing whether it was Jane Swift or Bill Galvin. You were right. It had to be Bill Galvin who decided to go ahead with this thing. But I think it was with some interface with Swift. But, you know, the unfairness. I know this sounds like I'm 4 years old to say this. The unfairness of this. This is important. Ted Kennedy filled a seat for four decades. Curry for three decades. We're about to pick someone who's not terribly old, who's probably going to be there 20 plus years, whether it's a Republican or Markey or Lynch. And by Tuesday, despite the best efforts of some media outlets, there's virtually – we're doing this, by the way, only because we felt a responsibility to do it today. It sure as hell is not what people are talking about, but we felt we had an obligation to talk about a pretty important election.
No, but there's an historical wrinkle here, too. You know, Europeans commented during the Second World War – only the United States, of all the democracies, held elections during the war. We hold elections come hell or high water, come the hurricane, you know, come the bombing in Boston. And it may be unfair to Steve Lynch, but it's a black and white ethic that we never reschedule and we go forward. And it's part of our DNA.
Well, my hope is that, while this marathon thing, and actually it's what we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes, I don't think the interest is going to abate in the next 7 days. But the hope is that every media outlet that has an opportunity talks about this campaign prior to primary day. And if you don't know, the primary is 7 days from today. It'll obviously narrow the field to one Democrat and one Republican. And by the way, in the most recent poll, sort of interesting, the Globe and the Herald both endorse. You're both from the newspaper industry. Yeah. You from the Phoenix. You from the Herald. The Herald and the Globe both endorsed Dan Winslow. It's rare that it's the same candidate. And Winslow is trailing the field, according to all polls, by 15, 20 points, which there's got to be some message in there. I'm not sure what it is, but there's something.
You know, let me ask you one question, last question before you go, because we're going to talk about this in just a couple of minutes. You ran the Phoenix for many years and the sorely missed Boston Phoenix. It's always a question in the news business when people's appetites for a particular story, when enough is enough and let's move on to something else. I wonder what you see as a newspaper man. Is the appetite for every single detail about the marathon, its victims, the businesses that are now struggling to get back on their feet down at Boylston Street, and the alleged killers here, is it sated yet, or do we still, is this a 24/7 still let's talk about the marathon?
I don't know if it's 24/7, but it's not sated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not sated at all. I think what will happen is it's not that the interest in the bombing will go away. Other things will crowd it out. Hopefully this election will be won. And it is a public service to talk about this stuff.
Well, you know, when you say crowded out, it looked last week, and admittedly it was much closer to Monday. There was a huge and historic vote on gun control.
Yes.
That got virtually no attention. The most important piece of immigration legislation filed since Ronald Reagan was filed last week. I would bet the vast majority of people don't even know that it was filed, much less. And because there's still so much of the story. We had Peter Galzinis in here yesterday. He wrote this unbelievable piece about this dance instructor who lost her leg, who says at the end of his piece, I'm going to dance again, and in fact, I'm going to run the marathon again. How can you not focus on the human toll here and, you know, this human spirit that is surreal, that is evidenced virtually every single day. Can't get enough.
There are many more stories of human triumph. I mean, some of these, I'm sorry to tease the listeners, but I can't go into them. But some of the things that various public safety officials did that officials, for whatever reason, don't want coming out now, nothing short of heroic.
Yeah.
I mean, very rarely in our own backyard do so many people get to be so heroic.
I think that's beautifully put. Peter Kadzis, formerly of the Boston Phoenix, we're thrilled now of WGBH. And by the way, we cannot tell you how proud of you we are. Not that you're GBH, but that you actually watched the debate last night. Peter, it means we can't. It is such.
He is a true.
It was so
civic
moving when you
American,
came.
Civic-minded American.
Peter
there
Kadzis, great to see you.
Thank you.
Okay, our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. We're going to talk next about what I just asked Peter Kadzis, whether you are still glued to the unfolding story of the marathon bombings, or would you like a little distraction? We're going to take stock of our saturation levels next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
curved glass, fruit trees, solar panels. The plans for Apple's gigantic new complex are like anything Silicon Valley's seen before.
Some people have described it as the mothership that has landed, or place for some kind of harmonic convergence, or as an iPod click wheel.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Apple's disruptive architecture, next on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and S&H Construction, offering to the greater Boston area for over 30 years residential renovations, custom building, historic restorations, renewable energy, site work solutions, and remodeling. Details at shconstruction.com. And Ellis Insurance, offering personal and business insurance, financial planning, and their online insurance tune-up, identifying relevant risk management solutions for families and businesses. Exceptional service, intelligent insurance. EllisInsurance.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Well, exhibit number one in our issue that we want to discuss with you at 877-301-8970 as to whether or not people have had enough. Do they need a break or want a break from 24/7 coverage of last Monday and its aftermath? Or, like many of us, is your only focus still all the unanswered questions and the victims? Exhibit number one is what we just did with Peter Kadzis, our total inability to find anybody but him who watched the debate. I would never have missed a debate in a critical election like this. I'm a debate obsessed. John Keller's a great moderator, all this. And it's critical of the week with 8 days to go as of last night. You can't stop. There's almost never a 15-minute period of time where there's not a news story online about a critical element. What did they learn in the interrogation of the younger brother yesterday? We're going to be joined in a couple of minutes by Bill Keating, the member of the Homeland Security Committee and a congressperson from Massachusetts. We read he's going to Russia. What's the attempt? I mean, there is never a second, and that's what we want to know at 877-301-8970. Do you need a break? Do you want a break? Or are you so transfixed by what happened 8 days ago that this is all you can take in?
We had several people commenting on Boston Public Radio's Facebook page asking this question. Have you reached the saturation point? Deborah Knott, she wants more info about the bomber in the hospital, his medical condition, his communications with the feds, anything on shedding light on why.
I'm with her.
She doesn't want replays constantly what happened last Monday, which is pretty upsetting. I think you have to reach a point where you say to yourself, do we need to keep showing the explosions over and over again? But Deborah's very interested in restoration of Boylston Street. We have another commenter who said he wants to know the over-under on how many TDs Tom Brady will throw in the next season. So apparently he's had enough. And one of the person points out that they have been under-informed about what's going on in the rest of the world because very little besides the bombing and the marathon has been in the news.
Well, I just said this to Peter Kadzis. And again, I am as much a problem in this regard, too. There are two huge things that happened in Congress that we paid no attention to. There were many deaths in West Texas last week. We haven't spent 1 second talking about what happened at that fertilizer
but
thing.
But Obama and Michelle Obama, the president and his wife, are going out for the memorial service. So they and you can't help wondering in a cynical way whether part of that he would not have gone had he not come to Boston. And you say, well, if you're going to go to Boston for the marathon victims, you have to go to Texas because more people lost their lives.
You know, and also one of the issues I think both for people in the business we're in, plus everybody, is it's a question of respect. I mean, even though you say you may be sated, if that's right, I've had enough. I mean, I really can't deal with the pain and anguish anymore. I really need some break. That's, by the way, why we played you the violinist yesterday, is we needed a break and we thought you needed a break. But it's just you feel there's almost a sense, at least in me, and I have a feeling in you, you almost feel it's disrespectful. When we learned this morning, as you said, it's not 170-some people with injuries. It's 280 people. A lot of people had ear injuries, for example, didn't think they were serious enough, thought they'd heal on their own. We read in the Globe this morning, well, they ended up back in the hospital because they were wrong. I mean, it's just you almost feel like you owe it in some ways to those who suffered and to the public, and I include myself in the public, till, as that woman said, Deborah, who was on our Facebook page, we don't know why. We have no idea why. A little bit of information from the interrogation yesterday of Johar that there was the Islamic connection had something to do with this. But I'm still not convinced they acted alone, even though authorities say there's just too much left out there unanswered, I think, to really move on.
And I think the other thing is, it's our city, so everybody has a connection. Your kids went to Cambridge, Ringe and Latin. My daughter's friends knew the younger brother. You have people over in Watertown who've been all caught up in this terror ordeal over there. You have people in Dorchester who, hundreds of people that surrounded this charter school that Martin Richard went to, and you got the children that are there, the parents, the neighbors, they're all dealing with a little boy who's not coming back and his younger sister who's very sick. You got the BU community, the MIT community. Everybody's got it's a 6 degrees of separation down to 1 or 2 degrees.
Have you even thought about writing a column on anything but this? Because you've written a column almost every day, not your usual days, but almost every day. Have you thought about writing about anything else? No, right?
No.
I
have not.
Both because that's where your attention is and that's where you think your reader's attention is. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Cambridge with David. David, you're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, David.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. Thank you.
Good. So as far as the saturation, I don't feel saturated because I feel like we've moved on to a different phase of information gathering and analysis.
That's a good point.
To look at a unique situation where people have resided here for a while, one more than the other, and find out how things led up to this point, and for preventative reasons, but also just to gain a greater understanding of how this could happen the way it did.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of fascination now with especially the younger brother, who everybody said was a great kid. How do you get radicalized in that way? There were reports this morning that down in his room at UMass Dartmouth, they found BBs, and there were many BBs and many of the guns, and they found some pyrotechnic device and stuff like that. So, again, he's 19, great kid, everyone said, and yet he allegedly did what he did. How do you get there? I think that's a totally fascinating piece that we don't know, and we may never know it, unfortunately, depending on what he tells us.
David, thank you so much for the call. Also, I realize we learned in the last 24 hours we've all been talking about. We talked about it on the show as recently as yesterday. Why the interaction with Sean Collier, who they allegedly ended up killing? And now we've heard the alleged reason is because only one of them had a weapon, and they wanted a second weapon. I mean, that's what's being reported. I don't know if it's been confirmed yet. Or, if it can ever really be totally confirmed. Maybe that's what Johar said in this interrogation yesterday. But that's a pretty interesting thing when a 26-year-old loses his life and is as beloved as this Collier guy seems to have been.
And then there's the other angle about this unsolved triple murder in Waltham from 2011.
Brendan Mess,
25 years old, supposedly a very close friend of the older brother, Tamerlan. Very close friends, yet Tamerlan didn't go to the funeral. That could mean nothing. It could mean something. It's an unsolved murder. The people that were killed were all like martial arts guys, personal trainers, very strong. So police are now looking again with new eyes at this murder.
Did you read the ABC News report on that? That while he introduced him at a boxing ring and elsewhere, Brendan Mess is his best friend, the older brother did, he didn't go to the funeral. And the family thought that was, by the way, talk about your 6 degrees of separation. They live a half block away from where I live. I mean, that is the point. Everything touches everybody here. There's no piece of this that escapes that. Let's go to John on Cape Cod. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, John.
Well, thanks for having me. I mentioned that I'm from New York City, and I'm here visiting a sick friend, mother-in-law who's ill, and I have been feeling very grateful. I've actually been in the car the last couple of days listening to your program, which I don't hear in New York, and I'm just kind of actually grateful because I don't feel saturated at all about the news coming from Boston. I guess it reminds me that even when things happen in our country, if you're just a little bit away from it, you can easily be distracted by your life. And of course, when 9/11 happened, we were all very much in that moment in New York. And I know people around the country were, but I just really feel connected more to the whole incident, the whole thing because of my being here. So I'm grateful for what you're doing and listening a lot.
You're a kind soul, John. Well, you remember the line. A line makes it sound like a pejorative. I don't mean it that way. After 9/11, we're all New Yorkers. And I think one can make the case, particularly if you're from New York, as you are, is that we're all Bostonians now, whether we're from here or not. John, thanks for your call and thanks for your kind words. Really appreciate it.
We have an email from Christopher who says, I think the mystery involved in the international aspect and whether there's a larger conspiracy, all those things keep you tuned in. And Emily talked about, Emily Rooney, that is our colleague for Greater Boston, every night at 7 o'clock, talked about the courthouse episode where there was a bomb scare, supposedly. Emily was suspicious. All these unanswered questions.
The flip side, by the way, is a Twitter commenter, and you can tweet us at BOS, short for Boston, BOS Public Radio, says, yes, I am tired of coverage. I'm tired of the groundless theorizing. And there's a lot of that. Big helicopters overhead and news crews everywhere. No, I mean,
that's true.
There is a lot
that's
of
true.
Theorizing, and there is a lot of report. I mean, I have to say again, if people weren't tuned in at 12 o'clock, we had John King, who's with us every Tuesday,
right.
Who obviously took a lot of crap for saying there was a suspect in custody when there wasn't, and his comment about a dark-skinned suspect. Rare is it that anybody in public life, and he's big time in public life, apologizes as heartfelt and as profusely as this guy did at 12 o'clock. I mean,
he did. It was a heartfelt apology and
honor in this.
And
actually,
I understand completely how that happens when you're dealing with police stories and law enforcement stories, because very often it's not Officer Joe Smith; it's a source that has been trusted.
You trust, right?
That you are not able to identify, because that's not how you get information sometimes from law enforcement.
But a lot of the reporting mistakes, and you said this to King when he was here, is because of this desire to be first rather than right. That wasn't the case with King. As
no,
you say,
he had a trusted source, and another colleague had another trusted source. One was local in Boston. King's source was local in Boston. The second source was a federal source from a colleague. I mean, you know, you go back to the Watergate rule. It was set by Ben Bradley at the Washington Post. We need two sources. We need two sources. We need two sources. And they were not frequently identified by name.
Let me give you, even though you and I are both CNN fans, I should have thought of this when King was here. I didn't think of it until just now. What's a good example of first was more important than right? Is when they reported, when I can't think of the woman's name, the woman reporter for CNN reported that the Supreme Court had overturned Obamacare,
right,
because she only read a portion of the decision, because their goal was to report what the decision was before she'd read the decision.
If we could just stop here for a second. Remember the visuals on that? Reporters are coming out of the Supreme Court. They've got like 9 pounds
telephone books,
paper in front of them. They're frantically trying to get through it. I think it would have been helpful if the Supreme Court had just basically had a paragraph that said, thumbs up, thumbs down, and
it's
why.
Not what they do.
It's not what they did, and frequently it's not what law enforcement does either. Not to criticize them, they do a great job, but sometimes there are agendas, and sometimes you are misled. I have been misled, and I was humiliated and embarrassed as well. Anyway, let's go to Sean from Worcester. Have we overcovered this, Sean, or not?
Hey, Jim, Marjorie, how you doing?
We're
fine,
good.
Thanks.
Thank you for calling.
I think we have overcovered it. I'm from Massachusetts. I grew up here my entire life. I feel horrible about what happened. It's just that what's happening is that it's being reported constantly. What's being reported is the same stuff. There's not really that much new information that's being reported, but your local newscast is basically the Boston Marathon bombing and the weather report. But they're rehashing the same information that you've already heard, and that's where the saturation comes in. Not that we don't want to know the new information, but there's only so much limited information that's new, and they're going to spend 45 minutes talking about the old information with only giving you 5 minutes worth of new information.
Yeah.
And that's
Sean,
where I think I'm getting saturated.
Can I respectfully disagree with you? I think early on, prior to the photographs being released, there was a day or so there, other than information, updated information on victims, both those who were killed and those who were injured, when it was clear that reporters and anchors were straining. They were showing the same video, the same. In the last handful of days, since the videos came out Thursday night, Sean, there has been, at least in my estimation, there has been a nonstop stream of large and small things. You know, yesterday, for example, one may not consider this big, the interviews that were done by some networks with the two parents, the mother and father, the whole story with the wife of Tamerlan down there in Rhode Island, and her conversion from this you know, sort of all-American kid to this devout Muslim working, 70 hours a week to support him?
As a home health aide, which surprised me, because she was she's still alive, obviously, a very talented artist.
So, Sean, at times I think your analysis is right. I'm not convinced right now that that's the case. But, Sean, thank you much for the call. We appreciate
and
it.
And I also say, not to mention my own column, but I have a column in the Herald today, which was,
I'll shill from
my own column. It was originally reported on this young woman's blog, and Salon picked it up, and I interviewed the mother yesterday, a Belmont woman, but this mother and daughter in Belmont beginning 6 years ago and just ending in January of 2012, went repeatedly to the home of the alleged bombers on Norfolk Street, that third floor apartment, to get facials because the mother apparently was an extremely talented facial. What's the word for the people that do that kind of thing? Whatever it is. It's a
cosmetologist, whatever she is. But she does facials.
And this young woman that was there gave incredible details about how they'd be in there getting their facial and there'd be, you know, cooking going on and sometimes arguing going on and how the mother was becoming increasingly radicalized that toward the end of the 6 years, she talked more a lot about Allah and the Quran and how she was arguing with her older son. And she also said she stopped going there after the increasingly radicalized mother said that 9/11 was made up by the American government so that Americans would hate Muslims. The young woman felt very uncomfortable after that because, you know, it's a vulnerable situation there. You're lying back in a chair letting someone work on your face and your neck and your head. And she stopped going after that remark was made. And there's also in the Boston Globe, if you haven't seen it, a just fascinating timeline about what exactly, by the second, the bombers were doing at the Boylston Street finish line, including details about one of the bombers, the younger one, dropping off his bag, waiting 4 minutes, then talking on his cell phone, and then walking away calmly as everybody else was reacting to it.
Yeah, they're all looking towards the first bomb, and exactly.
Yes, and the timeline is absolutely fascinating. That is all
I
new.
Agree.
Another new detail today is that the man who was carjacked, wasn't let off by the bombers.
He escaped.
Yeah.
And he has, boy, would you love to see him, by the way? And obviously he's worried about his privacy.
Low profile.
Let's go to Norwood, where Dave is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marty. What we're talking about is whether or not people have reached the saturation point or if they want more like I do. Hi, Dave.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
We're good.
So I have not reached the saturation point. When I do, you know, I just shut everything off. You know, I lost a lot of time working at the end of last week, so there's plenty I have to do other than read the news and listen to the news. But one thing I have become fed up with is the conspiracy theories, this, you know, endless paranoid stream on Facebook that I seem to have been caught up in refuting. And I think
paranoid stream about what? What do you mean?
Oh, you know, that the Marathon bombing it was perpetrated by the government
and
we've heard since then is the evidence of a cover-up.
Yeah.
I have to say I missed that one, thankfully.
There's a lot of odd stuff going on on the internet, I would say. And it's amazing when you hear people quote something that they saw and you say, well, where did that come from?
Well, because everybody became citizen crime solvers.
Yeah.
And in all fairness, I'm not defending at all those who were intentionally trying to mislead or creating some panic where no panic should be. But in light of the fact that the public's help was asked for from the head of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, mm-hmm. on down through the FBI and the police, you know, a lot of people were doing their best to be helpful. Some people probably crossed the line. 877-301-8970. Dave, thank you for the call. Let's go to Cambridge, where Carol is on. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hello, Carol.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'm not saturated at all yet. I mean, I find that I'm almost like obsessively listening. I have the TV on all the time.
Me too. Me too.
And I'm almost embarrassed because whenever it switches to another news story, I find myself flipping the channel.
Marjorie said the same thing this morning when she got in, Carol.
You and I are in exactly the same boat. When they go to talk, the weather, forget it. I don't want the weather. I don't want any sports. I just want to come back to this. I switch the stations too.
And I feel bad. It's like I should be paying attention to Texas and I should be paying attention to China and all this other stuff. And it's just like I can't. I'm just hungry. And I think it's because I can't understand it. I'm trying to get inside the head of this kid. And it's like, what could he have been thinking? I mean, how could he be like this regular, you know, Cambridge Rinjan Latin kid and not, you know, and not realize this was wrong? I mean,
so, Carol, I'm totally where you are and so is Marjorie. What happens when it's a week from now and then it's 3 weeks from now? And all there are is theorizing as to what happened to that, what everybody is describing as a sweet, decent young man who apparently, if the authorities are right, turned into a mass murderer 2 years later. What if it's never answered? Or at least not answered, and you're saying to yourself, maybe next week. How long are you here? My sense is I am here for quite a while.
Yeah, I think I'm here as long as there's still new information.
Yeah,
I am too.
There is now all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, the first day, I had the same feeling you did, that they were going over and over not knowing anything, and I got a little bored with it then. But then as soon as information
started coming. I was also just talking about the degrees of separation thing, too. I mean, I live, like, right between their... I mean, I was practically at their apartment on Thursday. We didn't know it was them. I was going to another event, and the other day I was on Arsenal Street in Watertown. I mean, it's just like, it's right here, you know? And we know people who work in Cambridge, Rindge, and Latin who've gone there or whatever. I mean, I don't know. It's just...
Well, that's what it is.
Everybody knows somebody. I mean, I was looking at the traffic today, and I was thinking every car that went by, every person in every car was affected by this.
Well, not only, you know, you talk about intimate connections. Who in this audience has not driven across the finish line of the marathon, and you still see the yellow stripe across the road for months and months? And so whether it's an arm's length connection or an intimate connection, everybody's got it. I think it's a great analysis. Carol, thanks for the call.
Stephen says saturation will be reached when Donald Trump offers a reward for the copy of the Brothers Middle School records.
God.
Thank you, Stephen,
lightening
up the hour a little bit.
Can we, staying on him, are you stunned that we are now in day 8 of this thing and he has not tried to insert himself? I'm serious. I mean, he makes a wonderful point.
Well, I think he makes it with humor. I think he's figuring out how to do it, how exactly the Donald can insert himself into the Boston Marathon tragedy. I don't know that he's without looking totally crass and opportunistic.
You mean as opposed to other things?
He always has some little tiny veil.
I would doubt that. I would rebut that, if I may.
Okay.
In any case, thank you kindly for your phone calls. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Up next, we're going to be talking to Boston City Councilor Mike Ross about the big hit businesses taken in the aftermath of the Boston bomb. He's going to tell you some great stories as well about what has gone on within the business community in downtown, helping out their competitors. Very great stories. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Millions of parents drop their children at daycare in the morning and hope they'll have a safe and happy day. But with the price tag topping the cost of rent in some cities, more parents are rolling the dice and turning to unlicensed care with sometimes devastating results. We'll speak with a writer who's looked at this and a panel of parents. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Northbridge Companies, who believe assisted living shouldn't be a place where time passes, but rather a place where time can come alive. You can find their local communities at nextgenerationseniors.com. And Frontline, discover how fees and kickbacks profit those in Wall Street while jeopardizing the secure future of the average American. Don't miss Frontline, the Retirement Gamble, Tuesday at 10 on WGBH2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Regan. Everybody is familiar with the human impact. And I don't mean economic. I mean the physical impact for those who died and the families that love them and the injuries. Now we think up to 280-some in the hospitals. Less obvious, except to those 400 businesses, which have been virtually shut down for 8 days, is the economic impact. We're going to talk to the owner of a business who's done some wonderful things during these 8 days. But first, we're going to talk to the city councilor who's on top of all this, who represents the area that has been shut down as it begins to break open a little bit. Joining us on the phone is City Councilor Michael Ross. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be with both of you. Thanks for focusing on this, and thanks for all your work.
So, Mike, we know that Boylston Street has been reopened, but we also know that many buildings have sustained damage, businesses have sustained damage, been out of work. What can the city do, and what's happening down there?
Well, the city has opened a, you know, a whole team. And in fact, they're meeting right now at the Heinz Convention Center, and they have a whole plan for opening out, for opening the street. There's over 400 businesses who have registered and have been in touch with a real amazing team that's been on the ground since Tuesday. Started in Park Plaza Hotel and just, you know, getting people ready for this opening. And the reality is these small businesses, many of them do not have insurance for, you know, terrorism. They're not covered. They have, you know, some restaurants have been closed for over a week. You have people who rely on tips. You have bussers and dishwashers who rely, obviously, on, you know, they paycheck to paycheck to support themselves and their families, you know, and probably well over, you know, 1,000-plus people, and from probably the restaurant industry alone, have been displaced and, you know, aren't working. And that's not to mention all of the offices and other retailers and businesses in the area. So,
but Michael, I'm interrupting just for a second, just to get to current events. This is Michael Ross, city councilor, who represents this area. What is the realist? We know the Heinz Auditorium thing. We're actually going to talk to a business owner in a couple of seconds who has gone through that process and has also done, I think, a wonderful thing for her employees. What's the realistic time frame for some and then ultimately all of these 400 businesses to be back online?
Well, I guess it's up to each individual business. I mean, from the city itself has already rolled out, you know, street by street plan to get this street open supposedly by 3 o'clock. And it's starting, you know, each block at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a meeting on that right now where people are going through that and getting ready. Some business owners have been allowed to get into their business to clean up. I mean, you know, the FBI has been really amazing here. I mean, here they are dealing with this investigation, and yet they've been able to get people into certain businesses on a case-by-case level basis, depending on whether or not, you know, a new piece of evidence was found. I mean, really amazing that they've been able to accommodate these types of requests. So some business owners have been able to get into their businesses. Some businesses, like Marathon Sports, for example, and I've been dealing, you know, and talking with Colin Petty, the owner of Marathon Sports, and obviously Forum, and some of the other businesses sustain impacts. And I know that Inspection Services has looked at some of the building structure itself to see if what's needed. I think most of the businesses are okay from a structural standpoint, and they just need to be cleaned up. But you're talking about, you know, restaurants that an entire, you know, on one of the busiest days of service, their entire dining room was left filled with people, filled with food, filled, you know, just food out, refrigerators, you know, stoves, coffee pots on, and they were left in that way for days.
Hey, Michael, Michael Ross, I want to bring this other woman in a second, but one last question for you. I read in the paper this morning, I think in the Globe, that it is believed that Ken Feinberg, who we hope to speak to tomorrow or Thursday, who was obviously the administrator of the 9/11 fund and has been picked as the administrator of this one fund Boston thing, that it is unlikely that businesses will be able to share in those proceeds, that it's for individuals. One, is that true as far as you know? And two, if it is true, where do businesses get any sort of compensation or something to deal with what they've lost in the last 8 days? Or do they get nothing? What happens?
Well, I don't know how the one fund is going to be distributed. I think Ken is the right person to do it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if those funds are for victims and for their families and for that group. And so I think the business community would be left with federal dollars. And we've, you know, been trying to get, you know, federal, you know, people from the federal government to tell us how the monies will come in. I mean, I know that the head of the Department of Neighborhood Development of the City of Boston is the mayor's point person on this as well, and she and I have been talking. I would imagine that there'll be some federal dollars that would come in and would be able to flow through either city or state government or both to get to affected businesses. But I have
and
no,
their employees, I'm
just,
hopefully,
just a guess,
and their then, employees, hopefully, right. too, right?
Right, and then
okay.
The real question is, how about these employees we just talked about, and
right.
then how long will it take to get those funds in?
Well, let's actually bring someone in who has decided on her own how to deal with at least her employees. Laura Truss joins us on the phone. She's the owner of a business that I think I have helped personally prop up over the years.
It's
called Finagle Bega. Laura, thanks so much for joining us on Boston Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So, one, what kind of impact? And two, what have you done with your roughly 20 employees since last Monday at 2:50, Laura?
Well, the store's obviously been closed since the bombings, and we made the decision right away that the employees would continue to get paid for the period of time that the store would be closed, in the hopes of, you know, doing just the smallest thing to prevent more innocent people from being impacted.
So your 19 full-time employees and your two managers in your store until it reopens are being fully compensated by your company?
Correct.
That's terrific. That's terrific. Laura, how much damage was there at the Finagle Bagel?
We had no structural damage at all. We just actually got into the store about an hour ago, and we were accompanied by inspectional services. The store structurally is fine. It just needs to be cleaned up.
And did you do that? Did you start with the Heinz thing that Michael Ross was describing a minute ago, and then they ushered you back? Did you go through that process today?
That's exactly right. We got an email, I think it was last night, that indicated by block what time we would be escorted back into the stores. And we showed up this morning at the Heinz, and they called us at noontime and escorted us down the street and into our store.
How much, when this happened, Laura, what did happen? Were you there at Finagle Bagel when the blast occurred?
I was not at the store when the blast occurred. My understanding is the law enforcement came up the street and came into the store and just told everybody to evacuate immediately. So our employees and all the guests just left right away.
Hey, Laura, why'd you decide to do that? I mean, the most legendary story like yours is obviously the guy who was called Polar Tech, Aaron Furstein, years ago when his place burned down, kept everybody on the payroll. It became a national story. He ultimately ended up going to the State of the Union, I think, sitting next to the First Lady. Why'd you decide that this was the way to go? I mean, there are other businesses. Abe and Louise is doing it, Atlantic Fish Company, Eastern Mountain Sports, but that's the minority. Why'd you decide to essentially front this money to keep your employees, hold them harmless through this thing?
I think in our business, we understand, I don't know who's speaking before me, but that people live paycheck to paycheck in the service industry, and that being out of work for a week is a financial impact that a lot of these people just can't sustain. So, you know, I'm a Bostonian. I grew up here. My family's here. We live on Beacon Street on the Marathon route, and these people are, you know, our family, and anything we could do to minimize the further impact of this thing is just the right thing to do. It never even crossed our minds to do anything otherwise.
By the way, the guy on the phone who's still on the phone before you is the city councilor, Michael Ross, who represents us here. What's your reaction to that kind of story, Mike Ross?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you and, you know, tell Laura that, you know, I work for you, right? I'm, you know, you're linked to city government. But we are hearing stories like that across the business district of the Back Bay. There was, on Tuesday, I called around to a couple of businesses that decided to open because there was some reluctance. And I called someone, another one of your neighbors, who runs and owns the bakery suite, you know, where they make the cupcakes. She told me she it didn't seem right for her to stay closed on Tuesday, but it also didn't seem right for her to charge people. So she started giving out at all of her stores. She gave cupcakes out quietly, you know, no press, to anyone who came in. I mean, these are the type of people we have. We have the Boston Properties, the giant, you know, real estate group that owns the Prudential Center and the John Hancock. They turned their marketing suite into a makeshift back office for businesses that were displaced, that needed to have access to the Back Bay area and, you know, access to a phone and computers. And we're hearing story after story of residents and businesses doing extraordinary things for each other and for strangers.
Hey,
and,
Michael, don't go away. I don't go away. Laura Trust, we want to say goodbye to you, but what's the web? We hope people will patronize your business like crazy, not just in Boston, but elsewhere because of your good deeds.
The
what's
muffins,
your website?
The muffins are extraordinary in addition to the bagels.
How do people find the locations? What's the website, Laura Trust?
We're www.finaglebagel.com.
Hey, Laura, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. And what a great thing, to do for your employees. Mike Ross, there was a great story in the Globe today about, you know, the Lenox Hotel became sort of ground zero because it's right there on the Marathon route, and they were running out of food. So from the Fairmont Copley Plaza, they got a huge bacon and sausage. People brought them over from the Colonnade. Somebody actually wheeled pasta and potato salad over on a luggage cart so the Lenox could keep feeding the police officers. We heard, you know, the Four Seasons was donating and the Kowloon and Saugus was donating. And in case of the Fairmont Copley Plaza and the Eastern Standard and Island Creek Oyster Bar, they're all competitors down in that area, except for the Kowloon. They're all competitors. And yet they were wheeling food around in luggage carts.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the story, is that Boston came together like never before. Part of our advantage of being a smaller city is everyone knows each other.
Yep.
And, you know, part of the disadvantage, I guess, maybe, is that everyone knows someone who was impacted by this. And so in a caring community, people help each other. They reach out to each other. And this, the whole notion of, competitors just kind of goes out the window. People just want to help each other, and they want to stand together. I'm seeing it in the religious community. I mean, listen, the only place that where politics is more evident in my business is in the religious community, where everyone's going for a different, you know, to try to increase
we
their flock.
It.
But
hey,
these people are pulling together. They're sharing a religious space. They're making, you know, all sorts of resources available to each other. It's truly an impressive show of force of this community.
You know, Michael, I don't want to sound unsympathetic to big businesses that were affected because I want them to open and that sort of thing. But it seems to me, and I'm sure you're working on this already, if we're right from what we read and the One Fund Boston is going to be directed to the victims as it probably should be, you should organize with the mayor, with whomever, something to deal with the workers who aren't lucky enough to work at Finagle or Bagel or Atlantic Fish Company or Abe and Louie's and weren't compensated, and the small businesses who really can't afford to be out of business for 8 days. I mean, is that on somebody's plate, the notion of something separate being done? I hope everybody's going to patronize these places like crazy once they reopen, but is that something that's on the burner for you guys?
Well, I've been in touch with our members of our Boston delegation, our federal delegation. It's interesting. I mean, think about this for a second. You know, right now we have the 99th and 100th United States senators in the United States Senate right now. Just a few short years ago, you know, we had
That's
John Kerry
point.
And
great
Senator
point.
Kennedy as our senators. I have huge faith and belief in our, you know, senators and our entire delegation, but it's a different delegation than it was a few years ago. And the ability to move mountains in Congress and get, you know, federal dollars here. I mean, think about how hard it was for Congress to get money into, for the disaster that occurred with Hurricane Sandy. And that's a whole, you know, and they couldn't get money for that, you know, so how are we going to get money into the hands of people who are hurting here, who've been out of work for a week? Also, think about this, that the Back Bay Business District is the same district that less than a year ago shut down for 3 or 4 days.
That's a great point, because of the power thing.
Yep.
That is a great point.
Yep,
Yep. So it's still, and not to mention a pretty tough winter, but that affects everyone, but it certainly affected this community as well. So this is the heart of Boston's business community. You know, this is very important to the survival of our city. And we need to thrive and we need to be strong. And so some of this is going to be us picking ourselves up, but we can't do it alone. And so some of these articles are making their way out to the rest of the country. And I'm getting emails from people all over the place saying that they want to help. I received an email from a guy.
We have 15 seconds, Michael.
All right.
I'm sorry.
This guy from the Bronx, he says, I don't even like the Red Sox. I'm coming, though, to go to a game, and I'm going to patronize Back Bay businesses instead of my usual North End haunt. No offense to the North End, because I want to support where the impact occurs.
Michael, quickly, what's your phone number, your office, if people need help from that district?
Absolutely, 635-4225.
Michael Ross, city councilor who represents this part of the world. Thanks so much, Michael. We appreciate and appreciate your work. We're really running up against it. We got to go. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow at noon, and we hope you are too. See you tomorrow.